Well, it is April Fool's Day, so I have peppered my sermon with bits of heresy, and you guys just kind of have to figure out what's true and what's not. No, I'm just kidding. That's not the case. But I was thinking this week that in some ways, Palm Sunday is an appropriate day for April Fool's Day, or April Fool's Day is an appropriate day for Palm Sunday. Because April Fool's Day is really a day where things kind of get turned on their heads. And you know, I think the obvious way of connecting the two is that, you know, Jesus comes into Jerusalem with these crowds praising him, and then in a week, the tables have turned, and the crowds hand him over to be killed. But I think, the more I was thinking about it, that really Jesus manages to turn things on their head, too. He marches into Jerusalem knowing all of the expectations that are surrounding him, that are surrounding this Messiah that the Jews are hoping for, that are surround the city of Jerusalem itself. And by the end of the week, he has completely turned all of these things on their heads. It's not that Jesus was trying to trick anyone, but he just doesn't fit into people's categories. People just don't know what to do with Jesus. He isn't just going to be who they want him to be or who they expect him to be. And Palm Sunday, as much as any other moment, and the Passion Week, as much as any other moment in Jesus' life or ministry, reveal the ways that Jesus challenges us and our expectations of him. On Palm Sunday, and in Luke 19 that we read before, we get a picture of Jesus and see that Jesus is King. He is the Messiah King. But he is a very different kind of king than we might expect, and certainly than what the people around him were expecting. In our story today of Jesus entering into Jerusalem, there are really two groups of people. There are the Pharisees, and there, of course, are the crowds with the palms. And I want to take a moment of looking at those two groups, what they thought of Jesus, and then talk about how Jesus presents himself and who he is. All right, and to do that, I'm actually going to ask you to flip the slide real quick. And I found this great icon painting, and I wish I could tell you more about it, but it's really hard to Google a painting when you don't know anything about it. So I don't have any information. I know it's kind of an Eastern Orthodox painting. But it does a really great job, I think, of portraying Palm Sunday and the story that we read from Luke. You have, of course, Jesus on the colt, surrounded by his disciples, the people who are praising him right around him. And then up in the upper right, you have the Pharisees kind of looking down on all these proceedings. Okay, so you see how the groups are all there that we read about in the story. And there are a couple other parts that we're not going to get into today. But I want to start with that group in the upper right, the Pharisees. And these are a group of people who are denying Jesus' kingship. Jesus' actions speak very loudly on Palm Sunday. As he enters into Jerusalem, the fact that he's riding and has prepared this colt or this donkey to be ridden into the city says something, as we saw in Zechariah 9. That was a big part of the messianic expectations of what this king would do, ride into Jerusalem on a donkey or a colt. The fact that he's coming into Jerusalem with a procession at all says something about what Jesus is saying about himself. And then the temple cleansing, as he gets into Jerusalem and he cleanses the temple, that was a very Messiah king type thing to do. And the crowds reinforce this message that Jesus is speaking about his kingship. They're quoting from Psalm 118. And unfortunately, these Bibles in our pews don't have some of the Old Testament references. If you're going to get a Bible, you get one with Old Testament references on the bottom. If you had one of those, you would know that their quote, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord," is from Psalm 118. And this was a psalm that the Jewish people had taken as a psalm that pointed to the Messiah, that said something about this Messiah king, and they're quoting it to Jesus. Blessed is the one, Jesus, who is coming in the name of the Lord. In other passages, we hear that the crowds called Jesus the Son of David, which is another king title, waving the palms. Again, all of these reinforcing this statement that Jesus is the Messiah king. And Jesus is processing in some ways, like a king. Scholars have found that it's very likely that on the day that Jesus is coming into Jerusalem on one side of the city, on the colt, on the donkey with the palms and all of this, there was an imperial governor procession coming in on the other side of the city. The pilot, who we know we encounter later in the story, was very likely processing into Jerusalem with a procession very different than Jesus's, but a powerful imperial procession nonetheless on the other side of the city. And that's what Jesus is doing as well, and almost mimicking that procession into the city. So everything about what Jesus is doing and what the crowds are doing is saying, Jesus is king. Jesus is important. And the Pharisees, who's in the upper right-hand corner, are looking down and they're concerned. The Pharisees, I think, have religious concerns. How dare you say you're the Messiah? Who are you to call yourself a king? They have religious concerns about who Jesus actually was. I think they also have some political concerns because, as I mentioned before, about the other procession coming in, Jesus is, why are you stirring the pot, Jesus? Things in Jerusalem were very tense. The Romans controlled the city, but there was a huge Jewish population, of course, in Jerusalem. It was a very important place to the Jews. There were already all kinds of political tensions in Jerusalem at this time. And Jesus coming in like this, saying he's the king, is stirring the pot a little bit, and I think the Pharisees are a little bit uncomfortable. And they come to Jesus in verse 39, and they say, "Teacher, order your disciples to stop. Order your disciples to stop." Maybe they're misunderstanding you. We'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Just tell them to stop. Correct them. Tell them that you're not really the king. Or even if you believe that, at least kind of quiet down, because we don't want to stir things up with the Romans around here. All right? The Pharisees are concerned about all these king claims going on. And I think we live in a world where a lot of these same kinds of doubts about Jesus and his kingship are all over the place. There are a lot of people who think it's foolish to believe that Jesus is anything more than some good teacher who lived a long time ago, imparted some wisdom, and then died, like a lot of our other good teachers, the Buddha, Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr. Jesus is one of this group, and to say he's anything more, some sort of cosmic king, is just stretching it. There are some who would go even further and say that it's actually offensive or dangerous to suggest that Jesus is the king. We can't live in a society where people are making such an exclusive claim that Jesus and no one else is the king. And there are lots of people who want to say, shh, quiet down. Jesus isn't a king. He was just a man who lived a long time ago. And even if you believe it, don't stir the pot. Don't stir the pot. Then there's the other crowd, the other group, the ones who are waving their palms and proclaiming the kingship of Jesus. And they are probably more in the right, I would say, on Palm Sunday, saying that Jesus is the king. But I think as the Passion Week moves on, Jesus' week in Jerusalem continue, we see that these are a group of people who may have known that Jesus was the king, but they misunderstood Jesus' kingship in some very significant ways. These crowds of people, many of them had been traveling with Jesus for much of his journey to Jerusalem. They'd heard his teaching. John tells us that these were some of the same people who saw Jesus raise Lazarus from the dead. And this is, they know that this is a big moment historically. If Jesus is the Messiah, this is hundreds and hundreds of years of expectations coming to fulfillment right now. They know that this is a big moment historically and spiritually. But Jesus is also kind of a hometown guy who's coming onto the big stage. I mean, think of Toledo's relationship with Crystal Bauer Sox. This someone we knew was a great singer, artist, whatever. When she gets onto American Idol, we're all excited, and I'm sure people were on Facebook, hey, she's from Toledo. This is a big deal to have someone in your hometown enter into the national stage. And that's kind of what Jesus is. He isn't, a Washington insider kind of guy. He isn't a Jerusalem insider. This is one of them from the backwoods of Galilee coming in who's claiming to be the Messiah. This is a big deal for these people. And the people in Jerusalem aren't rolling out the red carpet for Jesus. This isn't who we thought. They don't really know much about Jesus. Apparently they didn't see the YouTube video in Jerusalem about Jesus' healings and all the things going on. They couldn't care less. And so the people from his hometown and from his region are rolling out the red carpet, saying, You guys gotta see this Jesus. He's the Messiah, the King. Everything they do makes that very statement. But what did that mean to them? What did it mean for them for Jesus to be the King? What they expected of Jesus was what's expected of the Messiah in the Jewish community at the time. That the King would enter into Jerusalem on a donkey and with palms and all of these things. But what he would do there was restore Jerusalem to its to what it was supposed to be in God's eyes. To be this great city controlled by the Jews, the Jewish people. Get the Romans out, these oppressive Romans out. And they were oppressive in many ways. So get them out, get the Jews back in and on top in control of Jerusalem. That's what the people expected of the King. And that's why this procession is such a victorious moment. The King has come to conquer Jerusalem. The King has come to do what God wants him to do and restore Jerusalem to the Jews in power and in glory. And as the Passion Week moves on, we see that that's not really what Jesus entered Jerusalem to do, at least in the way that they thought. And I think the church has often acted as if Jesus were like all of the other kings of the world. That Jesus enforces himself on people, that he uses his power. The church in the West, especially the Western Hemisphere, has shown way too many times that we think Jesus is a lot like other kings of the world. Could point to the Crusades or the Inquisition or some of the things that happened in this country with the Puritans and the Salem witch trials and things like that, exerting power over other people. There are so many times, even still, that we play the world's games by the world's rules. We act like Jesus is a king like all the other kings that we know in our world. We've tried to get people to be Christian or to act Christianly. By marketing or by politics or creating rules and legislating it, by exerting whatever power we have over other people, acting like Jesus is just another king. So there's the group on one hand, the Pharisees, who deny Jesus' kingship. There's the group on the other hand, the palm wavers, who misunderstand Jesus' kingship. Who then is King Jesus? Jesus is caught in the crossfire of this argument kind of going back and forth around him. You're not the king. He's the conquering king. And Jesus manages to step outside of the argument because he doesn't really fit either of these groups' descriptions of him. And he says as much. When the Pharisees come to him and say, "Teacher, order your disciples to stop," he answered, "I tell you, if these were silent, the stones would shout out." Now that is a brash statement right there. He says, "I am absolutely the king. And not only am I just any king, the creation understands who I am. The creation, I am the king of creation. The stones would shout out praises to me if the people were silent." He says to the Pharisees, "I am absolutely the king." But then to this other group, who think that the Messiah is coming into Jerusalem to conquer and to restore it back to a national group. He doesn't fit that description either. He comes into Jerusalem and John tells us, as he came near and saw this, or Luke tells us, as he came near and saw the city, he wept over it. And then he talks about how Jerusalem is going to be destroyed by its enemies. It says, not one stone will be left upon another. This is not what the people were expecting of their king. So while he says to the Pharisees, "I am the king," he says to the groups waving the palms in praise of him, "But not that kind of king." These people have, in some ways, missed the basic imagery of what Jesus is doing. They've seen the donkey. as this sign of a king, but they haven't understood why a donkey. A picture of humility. They read Zechariah 9, but they didn't go on, where it says he's going to usher in, he's going to get all the war elements out of the nations and usher in a kingdom of peace, not a kingdom of force and power. Ultimately, Jesus shows exactly what kind of king he is by the end of the week. He is a king who is victorious not by destroying, but by suffering. He is a king who manages his kingdom not by building walls to keep certain people like the Romans out and certain people like the Jews in, but by inviting anyone to come to him and participate in his kingdom. He is a king who draws people to follow him not by making laws and threats, but by exhibiting love and welcome and grace. Jesus is the king, but a very different king than we might expect. Palm Sunday is the conclusion of the Lenten season. It's the beginning of Holy Week. And during Lent, we have focused on a variety of practices, soul training exercises, that focus on emptying ourselves. And we see the bowl, our bowl that is symbolizing our lives during Lent, is empty today. And hopefully some of us, as we've practiced some of these soul training exercises, have been able to empty ourselves of some of the things in our lives that just fill us up and kind of push God out. We've been focusing on emptying ourselves of the distractions. And some of you who were at the retreat yesterday, you recognize the puzzle. And we'll get back to this. But another way of allowing God to fill us now that we've been emptied. And I think Palm Sunday for us illustrates why it is important to do some of these soul training exercises, to engage in some of these spiritual practices of emptying. First of all, because Jesus is the king. Jesus is the king. We are so quickly and sadly mastered and ruled by other things. Mastered by other people's opinions of us, what they want us to do. Mastered by the constant force of noise and words coming into our minds. Mastered by food and the other desires of our bodies. Mastered by things and the need to fill our lives with them. Mastered by the craving for other people's approval of us. We need Jesus, not any of these other things, to be our king. To be the one who holds sway over our lives. And for this is true for if you consider yourself a Christian this morning or if you don't. Christians, we believe Jesus is king. We need to answer to him first. If you're not sure about Jesus this morning, Jesus is saying on Palm Sunday that it's only through me as your king that you can have a life of shalom, of peace, of wholeness, of being who you were created to be. It is only when Jesus is on top, is our king, that we can experience that life. And the soul training exercises we've practiced of solitude and silence and fasting and abstinence and secrecy, those are things to reorder our lives, to take down our fabricated kings and let Jesus be on top. And Palm Sunday also illustrates why we need these soul training exercises, because Jesus is a different kind of king than we would expect. These practices, if we are emptying our lives of all the other things in them so that we can focus on who Jesus really is, what we're doing is trying to set aside our preconceived notions of Jesus, trying to set aside the things we think we know so that we can find out who Jesus really is. In solitude, away from other people, we get to encounter the presence of Jesus. Not just what people tell us about Jesus, but who Jesus really is. In silence, we get to hear God's voice. When we fast, we get to experience the soul-satisfying goodness of God. in secrecy. We rid ourselves of other people's opinions and allow God to say, what do I think of you? Who are you in my eyes? When we practice these soul training exercises, we're able to have our picture of Jesus be transformed. Have our idea of what it means to live in his kingdom be transformed and changed. So now that Lent is over, and we're finished talking about some of these soul training exercises, or at least being introduced to them, it's not time to put away these soul training exercises. If you thought these soul training exercises were just something for Lent, April Fools, these are exercises that can infuse our lives with a picture of the true King and who he is. They're ways that we are molded and have our hearts and lives shaped so that we can proclaim Jesus to the world as the true King. But that transform our lives in a way that help us to do that in the way Jesus would want. Compassionately, humbly, with an eye to justice and grace. And so as we take the journey of Holy Week, as we get back together next Sunday for Easter, let's do it in a way that allows Jesus to take the throne of our lives and to show us exactly what kind of King he is. Let's pray. Loving and gracious God, be the King of our lives. We want to answer to you before anyone else because we know, Lord, that you love us, that you are for us, that you desire what is best for us. Be our King. May our lips praise you for it and proclaim it to the world. And I pray that our lives would be shaped by what kind of King you are, that we would be models of justice and compassion, humility and grace to those we encounter. Amen.